case on the calendar this morning for oral argument is the State of Minnesota versus Jason Stauffer. Good morning, counsel. While you are getting yourself settled, I'll remind you that you each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. It is important that you be mindful of the time as indicated in the lights at the podium. Also significant that you state your name and identify the party you represent, but I think you both know all of these things. So please take a minute. I know we've had a busy calendar this morning and lots of coming and going, but when you are ready, you may proceed, Mr. Axelson.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is DeVee Axelson, and I represent the appellant, Jason Stauffer. Mr. Stauffer's trial was overwhelmed with inadmissible and prejudicial evidence that told the jury that Mr. Stauffer had a propensity to stab people, that Mr. Stauffer was on meth, and that people who use meth are violent and unpredictable, and that the Hibbing Police Department, or at least the three officers who all testified at trial, all are familiar with Mr. Stauffer from multiple instances of prior police contacts.
But there, if I understand that last argument, the record is that, I mean, there wasn't any testimony by these three officers that they had arrested your client in the past or that he had been convicted of a crime. It was just, hey, I know him. I've seen him around, that
well,
kind of.
I think it was a little bit more than that. At least one of the officers indicated that they had had contact with him earlier in the day. They didn't specifically say, but I think the implication to a jury is that the police usually have contact with people who are getting in trouble with the law. Moving on to the Spriegel argument, the state made it very clear in their closing argument what they thought the Spriegel argument was admissible for. They told the jury, and
before we get to that, Mr. Jackson, am I correct? Did the district court properly give the Spriegel instruction, cautionary instruction at both the introduction of the evidence and its final instructions?
I believe so.
Okay.
But the district court did not indicate the state's probably most coherent stated reason for introduction of the Spriegel would be identity, and the district court did not include that in the instruction, nor was it specifically requested by defense counsel. But the problem here is that this didn't go to identity, this went to propensity, and that's the difference here. And with the cases kind of mark out the differences is something is substantially similar to a prior case that is admissible then as Spriegel evidence. But if it's just the same generic type of crime, that wouldn't be admissible. And here, I agree with the state that this court should look at the complaint that was introduced by the prosecutor in the district court and look at the facts from that case and not just cherry pick a couple of things, like both involve a stabbing, both involved allegations that he was on meth. That's where the similarities end.
Well, and it was both in the same town, and it's both people that he didn't know, really. I mean, it was sort of a random sort of offense in both cases. I mean, it wasn't part of it was the kind of the modus operandi aspect of it, especially when the identity was the issue at trial, as I understand.
Well, I agree that the things that you've said and the things that the state are relying on are true. The problem is they're very different when you actually look at the bones of them. In the first offense, the offense from 2010, he is walking out of a building with a friend. They're approached by a third gentleman. They end up fighting the third gentleman, and they're beating him up pretty good when a fourth gentleman decides to come in and try to help the third gentleman. And Mr. Stauffer, at that point, doesn't know the intentions of the fourth gentleman, takes out a knife and cuts the fourth gentleman in that instance. And that is very different than the allegation here that Mr. Stauffer is invited into an apartment, is hanging out, watching TV with two other gentlemen, and then out of nowhere,
And behaving very oddly as if he's on meth. Right. I mean,
yes,
that's part of it.
But the first offense doesn't really fit that dynamic. The first offense, there is some provocation when a fourth gentleman comes in to assist a person who's involved in a fight. And at that point, Mr. Stauffer, I believe in his statement to the police, was that he didn't know what was going on, felt, you know, worried enough where he felt he needed to defend himself against the fourth gentleman. And that's nothing like the present case. And I would like this court to, it's not in my brief.
And, you know, we can always parse out, you know, each, well, you know, he didn't assault that guy. I mean, he assaulted this person. But, I mean, they both sort of go to sort of the random and unexpectedness of the assaults. I mean, I thought that's really what the state was trying to do by introducing the Spiegel evidence. I mean, this is just such, not unusual, but just sort of out of the blue type actions. You know, who would do this? And the answer is someone who would do this who's on methamphetamine. So, well, I mean, I thought that was, and I agree, you know what, they probably didn't correctly follow the Spiegel notice into specifically what it was for. But sort of getting to the better picture, I mean, it seems to me that's what it was for.
Well, I would agree with you that the second offense, the second allegation, is random. I wouldn't agree with you that the first one is. I think the first one is a prototypical assault where there are people who are acting out for whatever reason, there's a fight, and then a fourth person comes in and Mr. Stauffer stabs that person. But in that case, it's still, you know, that's more typical of a typical fight. That is not Mr. Stauffer going up to somebody in a parking lot and stabbing somebody, or Mr. Stauffer going into a doctor's office and stabbing some random person. Those would be more similar to the current offense. And I'd ask this court to look at State v. Stegan. It is an unpublished case, 2017, Westlaw 4228689. And Judge Flora, you were on that panel. And that case talks about how the Minnesota Supreme Court requires more when you're using Spiegel evidence to prove identity and showing the similarities, and that they require more than just the general same type of crime or the fact that both occurred in Hibbing. And in the Stegan case, they were saying that multiple instances of the guy being involved in methamphetamine was too general to show some type of similarity. And in order to show identity, you really need some type of similar modus operandi, and we just don't have that in this case. And the further problem is we have the state telling the jury in closing argument.
I mean, both were strangers, though, right? I mean, both victims were strangers.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes. Although in the second case, the case that we're before this court on,
he knows the person in some way. Well, not the victim, though.
No, but okay. his friend does. In the first instance, other than Mr. Stauffer and his friend, the other people don't know each other, including the fourth person who came in to help the third person.
So my question is a little different. We've been talking about here what information the trial court judge had in making his decision as to whether or not this other crime evidence was admissible, Spiegel evidence, and ultimately determined, it's going to be admissible on the issues of identity or modus operandi. And that was all done pre-trial. The judge had the complaint. The judge had the information leading him to his conclusion that there were sufficient similarities to admit it on an abuse of discretion standard. Take that and then go to what the jury was presented with. The jury didn't get any of the information that the judge had in making his abuse of discretion decision to it, that it was admissible. The jury got a redacted transcript that basically said, yeah, I agree, I stabbed this guy on that day outside of an apartment in Hibbing. They didn't get any information that he was under the influence of methamphetamine at the time or any of these other things. There was no objection to the method of presentation by his trial counsel. So, I mean, on the one hand, in a pretrial ruling, the judge says, yeah, there's no abuse of discretion because of all these similarities. But then on the other hand, the jury's not given any of the similarities to judge from.
Right,
and that's not objected to by his counsel at trial.
Well, and stipulated to, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean,
the focus of our argument is on the admission.
Yeah, I know it is, but so you're limiting your argument to whether or not the judge abused his discretion at this pretrial hearing in allowing this prior incident to be admitted.
Yes, and I think that the evidence that's presented at trial could cut both ways.
I agree, and I suppose that's why there wasn't an objection, because I know counsel at trial, who I quite frankly know personally. I was a trial judge when he got beat up by his counsel in a jury trial, State v. Lehman. So, you know, it's all kind of beside the fact, but, and I understand the trial strategy about it, but as I was reading the briefing, I was really troubled by the fact that it was admitted on one ground to help the jury understand why this current crime was committed, but the jury wasn't given any information to help them understand that. I understand there's a trial decision that might strategy decision, but to me, there was really having ruled on many Spriegel motions over the course of my judicial career, there was a real disconnect that, quite frankly, I don't know that I'd seen before between what the judge relied on to make an admissibility decision and what the jury was given for the purpose. It troubled me. I understand where your argument is and what your issue is here, but there was a disconnect in my mind between what happened pretrial and what evidence the jury was given for that purpose.
Well, and the harm for what actually gets admitted comes from what the state tells the jury in closing argument when he says that's how he does things. That sounds like propensity evidence to me. That does not sound like this is his modus operandi. I mean, he does say modus operandi in the same sentence, but how he does things sounds like propensity.
Well, what if he had said, this is how he does things when he's on meth?
I mean, that gets to our second argument.
Right.
And the second argument, our main focus of that is on what the officer, Sergeant Arola, testified to, that the general tendencies of people on meth. And I think both this court and the Supreme Court have made it very clear that that's just not proper to do.
But here, I mean, it was relevant to the issue of identity, was it not? Because the victim, I mean, one of the things the victim told reporters was, hey, I'm a former meth user. I think the guy who randomly just stabbed me out of the blue was high on meth. And the fact that the neighbor down the block, or, you know, down the street found somebody later, and then the officers made the same observations about your client's demeanor. I mean, it seems to me that's relevant, and I understand prejudice, but district courts have to weigh, you know, relevance and prejudice all the time.
Well, Your Honor, that would go to evidence that he was on meth. That's only part of our argument. The stronger part of our argument is what Sergeant Arola was actually permitted to testify to over the defendant's objection, and that's that Mr. Stauffer, or that people on meth are aggressive, unpredictable, and violent. And that goes way past what is permitted based on the case law. So if there is an argument, and I think that's the argument that's made by the state, that may undercut part of our argument that whether he's on meth is irrelevant. The second part of the argument is there's no response from the state, or there's no argument, no cases cited that support their argument that undercut these drug courier profile cases that essentially say it's bad character, that you can't show that certain people act a certain way, and so they're acting a certain way on this occasion. And that's what they attempted to do, and that's what they did by introducing Sergeant Arola's testimony about some cop and how he knows how people act on methamphetamine. And the state also in jury voir dire, when we didn't specifically object to that, but they're laying a roadmap to make the jury think people on meth are violent, unpredictable, dangerous by bringing that up in voir dire. And then they really nail it home by having Sergeant Arola testify to that. And that's the damage in this case, is that just simply by him being on meth shows that he's somebody who would have acted this way in order to prove identity. And that's not whether he's
on... That goes to motive too, doesn't it?
Motive, yes, go to motive. And that's not a proper use. And actually the state doesn't specifically argue, motive in closing. So they weren't trying to show motive here. They said that we may never know why Jason Stauffer, who they claim stabbed this guy, did this. They don't focus their case on motive. They just focus their case on identity. So they're not really trying to prove motive with Sergeant Arola's testimony. They're just trying to undercut the jury's fairness and how they decide this case, and using the fact that he's on meth in order to show that he's a violent person, an aggressive person, and why he would have done this if he was simply on meth. Unless the court has additional questions.
I did have one question. Did the Spriegel evidence come in before or after DJ's testimony where he kind of first failed to identify him and then did identify him?
I believe it came in rebuttal, and the judge had reserved a ruling until later on in the case.
But doesn't that bolster the argument that the Spiegel evidence was necessary on identity because the victim first couldn't pick out the defendant in the courtroom, which would suggest there's problems with identity.
I don't think we get to that point of the Spiegel analysis because it is not markedly similar. It's not substantially similar. It is just the same generic type of crime, and that's where the similarities end. The fact that the biggest similarities is same defense attorney, same prosecutor. They both happen in Hibbing. You know, Hibbing's a small enough town. That's not enough to show modus operandi. That's not what the cases establish. You know, similar town. You know, those type of facts. They want something more than that, and that's what this court held in Stegen, and that's what they pointed out that the Supreme Court requires.
That's
more.
What the cases say. But for the most part, the facts are pretty thin when we affirm Spiegel, the admission of Spiegel evidence. I mean, I think it's fair to say I've seen cases with thinner similarities than this that we've affirmed on Spiegel convictions.
Well, I would just ask.
But maybe you'd like this to be the first one.
In closing, I would ask you to follow the Stegen Court, which is just from 2017, and had Judge Flory on that panel. Thank you.
All right, thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Michael Everson. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. And I'd like to begin by making clear that the district court made its Spiegel ruling at the close of the state's case. So it was after DJ testified. And what the district court found, based on the record that it had before it, are a number of markedly similar circumstances. And I'd like to highlight what those are. And I am relying in pointing to these circumstances on the plea transcript. So these are appellant's own statements, and this was how the state had intended to prove the Spiegel incident. Appellant stabbed a victim. The victim was a stranger. There was the use of a knife. Again, this is in both cases. Stabbed the victim in the upper chest area, and this is established at page 8 of the plea transcript, in nearly the same location in the city of Hibbing. And as appellant admitted in his plea transcript from the 2010 plea, methamphetamine use induced him to engage in this, you know, somewhat bizarre conduct. He admitted as part of that plea, and again, this is page 9 of the plea transcript, that he was confused because he was under the influence of methamphetamine. And that, again, is the state's theory as to why appellant stabbed DJ in this case.
And I understand that, but I share Judge Flory's concern about the fact that the reasons why the evidence was admitted exist, and the reasons were that to provide a jury with helpful information on the issue of identity through showing this prior behavior, modus operandi kind of evidence. Doesn't seem to me the jury really got that evidence. So what are we left with?
I would agree with that by and large. And just to give some context for what happened, the district court said it was going to allow in the plea transcript, which included all those facts. There were some redactions that needed to occur to that plea transcript because it referenced a previous case and probation and such. So the district court invited appellant's counsel and the state to meet and confer and to agree on redactions. And the parties agreed, and again, I don't know why they agreed to take so many facts out.
Well, yeah, it strikes me that it became exactly propensity evidence as presented to the jury.
Sure, and so what was actually presented to the jury was the fact that appellant stabbed another individual with a knife in roughly the same location. And so, yes, I understand the court's concern. I think in hindsight, it certainly would have been better if all of these additional facts came in. Frankly, I think it would have been much better for the state if all of these additional facts came in. But again, when the district court ruled, based on the record it had before it, including this plea transcript, which was how the state intended to prove the case, there were marked similarities between the two incidences. In addition, when we weigh the probative value against the risk of unfair prejudice, the district court noted it was going to give a cautionary instruction. The court also Actually, the court didn't note this, but one additional factor was that this evidence was going to come in kind of a dry form, simply a plea transcript, not compelling live testimony. It was only going to take about 30 seconds to offer to the jury.
The court in that instruction indicate why the evidence was being presented?
The court did not.
Okay.
There was no request for that. The Minnesota Supreme Court, I cite two cases in my brief, in which the court recognized expressly that the cautionary instruction, the standard jig, which was what was given here, sufficiently cautions the jury about how they are not to use that evidence. And again, that was done here. There was no request, and in fact, defense counsel expressly agreed to the giving of this cautionary instruction. Now, putting aside...
That was wrong.
The cautionary instruction.
Cautionary instruction, and it's been a while. I mean, it explains why it's being introduced, and then it says, and it's not being introduced for this. So the instruction was given, just said, well, it's not being introduced for this, but it didn't say why, which would lead the average person to think, well, what?
So the Supreme Court has addressed these exact concerns, and I just want to read something the Supreme Court has written, because I think it directly answers that question. We have stated, and this is from Truey versus State, it's a 2004 Supreme Court case, I believe it's in both of our briefs. We have stated that as a general rule, instructions on particular kinds of evidence should be avoided as much as possible, because they tend to inject arguments into the judge's charge. Crimjig 3.16 leaves it to the attorneys to argue the possible inferences that can be drawn. We have utilized this approach because Spriegel does not always fit, and I mean, they explain, but in a sense, in this case, as well as the other case cited in my brief, the Supreme Court comes out and says, this is an adequate instruction. This protects the defendant's rights. I do want to make a very brief, or ensures that the jury does not improperly use.
You know, and you have the case in front of you, I don't. In the excerpt you read, I didn't hear anything that said, oh, and by the way, if you leave out the reason why it is being entered, that's fine, or it's harmless error, or something like that. I mean,
So I actually have a second case.
Look at that. You anticipated my weakness of my question.
So this is State versus, and I apologize, I'm terrible at last names, but State versus Brolic. It's a 2000 Supreme Court case also cited in my brief. And again, this is near the end of the case. When the substance of a particular instruction is already contained in the trial court's instruction to the jury, the court is not required to give an additional requested instruction. Here, the jurors received an accurate instruction admonishing them not to convict the appellant based on his prior crime. The standard crimjig instructions adequately caution the jury about how the Spriegel evidence could not be used. A more specific caution focused on impermissible character inferences from Spriegel evidence would not be prohibited, but it was not an abuse of discretion to use crimjigs 2.01 and 3.16. And I know elsewhere in this opinion, the court holds that it is not error for a district court not to instruct on the impermissible purpose and the permissible purpose unless a specific request is made by the defendant. And again, here there was no request, and in fact, the defendant expressly agreed to the standard instruction.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument that the testimony about meth use went far beyond what was relevant to either identity or motive and really crossed the line and became prejudicial or unfairly prejudicial?
Unfairly. Absolutely. So there were two purposes, really, of the meth evidence. One, it is relevant to identification. Obviously, the victim describes these characteristics, and then the officers later observe these characteristics. But more to the point is what we have in this case is we have an individual who enters an apartment, and he sees a guest who he does not know at the apartment, a complete stranger, and he all of a sudden lunges at him and stabs him in the chest with a knife. And if I'm a juror and I'm looking at those facts, I'm going to be thinking if there isn't some explanation as to why the juror or why the appellant is engaging in this conduct, is this really what happened?
Maybe it was mental illness. I mean, what evidence in the record was there even that Mr. Stauffer was under the influence of methamphetamine? Did he have paraphernalia on him? Did they find baggies in his pocket? Was there a blood test? Did they get any evidence that that kind of jumped out at me, that everybody's assuming he's on meth, and probably he was. But was there any evidence that he was?
There's no evidence of the kind you described. However, the district court cautioned the state that it was going to be very careful about ensuring that there's proper foundation for any witness who testifies that he believed the appellant was under the influence of methamphetamine. The victim testified that he had used methamphetamine in the past for over 10 years, and that what he was seeing in appellant is exactly how he behaved when he used methamphetamine. The police officers testified specifically about training courses that they've taken through the Minnesota State Patrol, in which they learn to detect when a person is under the influence specifically of methamphetamine as well as other drugs. So I think that is evidence that appellant was under the influence. And
you know, he could have been under the influence, certainly. I agree with you 100%, but I think there's a lot of other explanations, too, that might explain that behavior that would call into question whether the officer, I can see the victim saying, yeah, you know, that's how I acted when I was on meth, but then to go to the next point and sit, you know, I question whether or not that was helpful to the jury when there was no other independent evidence that he had used any methamphetamine.
I mean, I think this goes to the weight that the jury should give to it. If the jury, you know, looking at the witness's qualifications and the witness's explanation as to how they or why they believed appellant was under the influence of methamphetamine, if the jury finds that credible, then the jury can reasonably conclude he was under the influence. And again, the officer's explanation based on his specific training in methamphetamine about how it can often induce people to engage in very unexpected, somewhat bizarre behavior, that's helpful to the jury to understand why appellant would engage in, frankly, a very bizarre act of stabbing a stranger without any provocation.
And he did, I mean...
Oh, no,
go ahead, Judge Fleury. I it looks like you do have some evidence of Sergeant Rolla testifying that he had visible body tremors, exaggerated speech, and auditory hallucinations.
Correct.
Which would suggest, and then he said, oh, and by the way, you know, those are all the things meth users have. So at least, I mean, I think there's, I share Judge Fleury's concerns that, you know, there, you know, it would have been nice if you had had a needle on him, because then it's like, well.
I agree. Yeah.
But you do, there was some connection to what meth users have versus, or do, versus what the defendant in this case did or
showed. Correct. Yeah, this is not simply a case where an officer said, oh, I thought he was on methamphetamine. There was specific testimony about body tremors, you know, as Judge Conley mentioned. There was specific testimony that while appellant was in this holding cell after he was detained, that he was appeared to be trying to have a conversation with a person that wasn't there. So, I mean, we're talking about objective characteristics. I did want to briefly respond to the drug courier profile argument. And I did want to point out that if you read the State versus Williams case, which is the primary Minnesota Supreme Court case on this point, cited in both of our briefs, the court does note that not all cases will this sort of testimony be excluded. And it noted one instance, citing the Seventh Circuit case, that testimony that is admitted to explain the defendant's conduct, that that's a possible exception. And I'm in no way conceding that this is drug courier profile testimony. I think there's a major distinction between that and the physical characteristics or the physical reaction that a person has to methamphetamine. But that point aside, the Supreme Court in Williams has recognized that this type of evidence can be relevant to explain a defendant's conduct, which is particularly important in this case because it is very bizarre and somewhat unexplainable conduct without this type of evidence. With my time remaining, I just want to briefly respond to the last argument relating to the testimony that the police officers recognized appellant. Now, first, to be clear, only two of the officers indicated that they recognized appellant. The third officer said that he heard from one of the other two officers that he recognized appellant. So we're only talking about two. But this is a plain error standard because there was no objection. And the Valentine case that I cite in my brief specifically says where identity is at issue, then this evidence is admissible. Therefore, plain error cannot be shown. With that, the state would ask that this panel affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you very much.
But you concur with the appellant that even if we were to affirm, we would need to direct vacation of the conviction for count one?
Correct. For whichever count I identified in my brief, yes.
Okay.
I do. Thank you.
Mr. Axelson, you have the last word.
Just briefly, I wanted to cite to the record at 263, 264, the state in its closing argument made only one reference to why Mr. Stauffer did what they thought he did, and they said, we don't really know, and we may never know. So they were not attempting to use this evidence to prove motive as the state is now arguing on appeal. They're just using it as bad character evidence to make him look like a violent person just based on the fact that the police later in the night saw him on meth to establish this crime, which is not a permissible reason. I want to go quickly to the Spriegel. Even if this court agrees that the district court didn't abuse its discretion, this court could still reverse based on the state's argument to the jury that using this as propensity evidence and not using it for the stated purpose of admission, or potentially based on the reasons discussed today with how the evidence was presented. And third, in response to Judge Connolly's questions about the failure to instruct the jury that this was only supposed to be admitted for identity, the cases that the prosecutor cites today, I believe, are older cases. I think there are newer cases, and unfortunately, you know, we didn't raise this because it's not objected to, and there are meteor issues regarding the Spriegel, but I think there are newer cases that discuss the need for a more specific instruction. I don't have any of those off the top of my head, and I don't necessarily think they're pertain to this case, but I wanted to respond to Judge Connolly's questions about them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments today. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision in the statutory 90-day period.